Well, it is a Friday morning, and it's the day after Thanksgiving, and once again, it is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David joins us on a Friday morning. His website is themediabeat.us. He also is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. Good morning, David.
Well, hello. Glad to be reporting in from the media capital of the world, New York City, and once again joining the indefatigable Marshall Miles. I hope you had a good Thanksgiving, Miles.
Can't complain about it, David. I hope you had one, too. This was the first year I didn't cook a big turkey. I got a 3.5 to 4 pound turkey breast. It supplied just as much turkey as the big turkey, and it was much easier to cook.
And no bones to worry you or no. get involved with, huh?
Yeah, it was much. I don't know why I didn't do this earlier, but anyway.
There's always an easier way.
Yes.
It's up to us to find it. Not always quickly, though.
Well, it goes to show you, you can watch Law and Order on TV as much as you want. Two different judges, two different courtrooms, two different verdicts that happened over the course of the past week and a half.
Oh, absolutely. The media have been awash this week, of course, with those two widely differing verdicts returned by two separate state courts, Wisconsin and Georgia, in Kyle Rittenhouse's murder trial and, of course, in the trial for the murder of Ahmaud Arbery. You'll remember how we discussed last week the similarities in the defense arguments in both those two cases, the claim of self-defense. Essentially, the claim that the accused believed their gun would be taken from them and used against them. Well, that claim was believed, evidently, in the Rittenhouse case and not in the case of the three men who killed Mr. Arbery. The very fact that two opposite verdicts were returned is evidence for many in the media commentariat, anyway. And it's hard to disagree with it. It's evidence of our nation's deep division and polarization. The meaning of each verdict is going to be fought over, verbally at least, and maybe in the streets, I'm afraid to say, for long after they're both front page news, as they have been over Thanksgiving. It was touching, indeed, in the Georgia case, to see how many people were on such edge as the verdict approached, and the jury was still deliberating. But on the eve of Thanksgiving, the verdict came in, and the community there was treating it very much as a piece of good news for which they were extremely thankful, and Thanksgiving Day for them had that extra resonance, and the message of how much it meant was all bound up with the gratitude traditionally expect on Thanksgiving Day.
You know, you look at the racism in this country, but you also can't overlook that you have two different trial judges, you have two different prosecutors, and also the makeup of the juries were quite different. So it's hard to compare the two, but there were some absurdities in the first trial, and the second trial seemed a little bit more under control by the judge.
Two different judges, that's for sure. I suspect, as the legal proceedings, you know, do move forward, there will be much reflection on how each case was directed, as it were, by the presiding judge, the commuting judge, and in the case of the Rittenhouse acquittal, that's going to be rehashed in many ways too, I'm sure. As I say, long after it passes away from the front pages and the top of the bulletins, it's indicative, of course, of something that was in a way studiously avoided in the Georgia case, in a formal sense anyway. It's arguable that in legal presentation terms, at least, racism was just not on the agenda in the Georgia case, though of course it was the subtext all the time. In the Rittenhouse case, racism was also a subtext. In that case, you know, neither the accused nor the victims, who interestingly, in one of those instances of legal direction by the judge that really calls out for reconsideration, they were not even allowed to be called victims. The people who were killed and injured. What you found that with neither accused nor victims, which is exactly what they were, of course, two dead people and one seriously injured, in all cases they were white. But that did not stop the United States history of racism from looming very large behind that case, and that, of course, is why these cases do have the resonance that they do. There's simply no way of getting away from it. Some people call America's original sin, slavery, is, of course, still working its way through in all our country's institutions and in the minds of most Americans. It's impossible to get away from it. And until we confront it fully and thoroughly, that's going to remain the case.
Yeah, I want to go on to another trial that we haven't spoken to, and it's coming up. It's going to start Monday, and that is the friend of the very notorious Epstein, Maxwell's. Her trial is going to start on Monday, and what's interesting about that, and I don't know how normal this is that the judge for that trial has now been is going to be recommended to a higher court, which might either delay or change judges in the course of that trial.
Well, yes. talk about sensitivities. Sure, it's a hot button trial, or a set of hot button issues. But I suppose what this whole case speaks to is the idea of privilege. Race is involved in this in a sense. When you talk about privilege, a lot of the time you're talking about privilege amongst people who are white. That again is a given part of our historical heritage, but the legal shenanigans being invoked as this case approaches trial are considerable, and if the arrangements for presiding over this case change, then that is what will happen. But what the case throws up, of course, is the extraordinary capacity for people with wealth and connections to carve themselves special deals. It was certainly the case with Epstein himself in Florida, managing to escape the full weight of the law when he was involved in sexual charges, which resulted in a guilty verdict, but was such a light hand applied in the punishment because he had a lot of influence. Still, even despite the negative kind of case that he was facing and in which he was found guilty, and in the case of his aider and abettor, I have no compunction in using those terms. I don't think I'm committing any kind of contempt of the trial to say that about Ghislaine Maxwell, but she will face charges after a long time trying to struggle against her conditions of pretrial imprisonment, for instance, which speak once more to the idea that there's a certain kind of comfortably off, can I put it that way, white American who believes that the law just doesn't appeal to them, doesn't apply to them, rather. It's certainly not appealing. They'll use every kind of course of appeal, every kind of route out of what the law says, which is, of course, that it is the same for everyone. They try and make themselves into special cases and get special treatment. And the tensions involved as this case has approached its trial date speaks to that very, very clearly, that some people believe that they're above the law, or at least the law doesn't quite apply to them in every detail in the way that it does to anybody else. But we'll see how the case unfolds.
It's interesting
in the court.
You know, it's interesting to look at it. What makes the case even more stand out, even more dramatically? And you mentioned it just talking about it, is the worldwide association of very famous, rich people that have come to the, you know, I won't say support, but really, yeah, it's kind of support. It really it shows it really increases the us against them, the super rich, the super wealthy against regular people. And this isn't just in America. This is this case is worldwide, actually.
Well, of course. I mean, the network of privilege are almost by definition international. people of that ilk, if I can use a lovely old-fashioned English and Scottish phrase, of that ilk are of that ilk because their capacity for evading authority is beyond borders, and it's a frontierless kind of life that can be led if you have the dollars with which to purchase that lifestyle. They're not called a jet set for nothing, and private jets figure very largely in the Epstein case overall. And yes, friends, I put the word in quotation marks, air quotes, because there are people in Epstein's circle who are now very anxious to demonstrate that they had no connection with him, never expressed any approval of what he got up to, and certainly wouldn't count themselves as his friends. But at the time, that was a well-used phrase, often used. I am a friend of Jeffrey's. Was almost a code for, in certain circles at least, for, you know, how close they could join in the junkets and the trips that Epstein ordered, and whether, you know, these individuals actually took part in the horrible things that he and his team, let me put it that way, arranged for the delectation and delight of visitors. There was nonetheless this sense of hugger-mugger conspiracy going on all the time. How do I get on to the next flight? What do I have to do, and how much do I have to pay, if you like, in terms of hospitality in return, to be able to be in this charmed circle, a charmed circle that did believe, and of course it included people of very elevated social status. I'm thinking of Britain in particular here, that notion that they are somehow above the rules and regulations that apply to us, and indeed the morality that is supposed to apply to all the rest of us too.
All right, I want to move on to the relationship between France and the UK. I mean, once again, the President of France has reacted to something Boris Johnson said. Johnson, of course, publicly called for France to take back migrants who reached the UK.
Yeah, well, it's all occasioned by this appalling loss of life in the English Channel, a bit of sea. The English appropriate in its very name, in the English language at least, calling it the English Channel is a bit of a stretch, since it's between two different countries. The French call it La Manche, just meaning the sleeve, the strip of seawater that separates these countries, by not very much distance in certain parts. It's a very close contiguity. Well, not quite contiguity, because they don't touch, of course, but there's this narrow strip of water there But the loss of life involved in this capsizing of 27 migrants drowning has been shocking for both countries. And the response, of course, is that Britain and France are now vowing publicly to work together against the people traffickers that expose these migrants to the terrible risks of doing this journey in really not very seaworthy craft. But at the same time, Britain and France are also pointing fingers of blame at each other about who's most at fault. The French are saying that, finding many things at fault with the Brits, mostly what the French are saying, I suppose, is that the English are politicizing it, and it is mostly the English part of the British establishment, the British government administration, are saying that the French are at fault for creating conditions that make migrants want to take that extra leap away from their original home countries. When they get to France, they're in horrible camp conditions, which make them want to go even further. And they have this idea. So many of them have the idea that that England is the ultimate goal that they're aiming for. And if anyone's puzzled about that, one simple fact. Apart from the admittedly terrible conditions in what's known locally as the jungle, the camp in Calais on the French side, where things are very tough, and the raids that take place make life there pretty impossible. But why cross that extra stretch of water? Why go to Britain? Why is it so attractive? Well, the answer lies in surveys that are done amongst the people who are in the jungle, the so-called jungle, and you'll find, unsurprisingly, I guess, that over half of the people there have some family connection with people in Britain. So it's not any great mystery. Just simple shoe leather journalism will reveal the fact that people want to go to Britain because they already have family connections there, and people pay a terrible, terrible cost for making that effort. And if you look at the if you look into the kind of craft that are used by the people smugglers to get the people across, it's no wonder that these capsizes do take place. It's very similar to the situation in the Mediterranean when people are trying to reach EU countries from Africa and from the Middle East. They're just not seaworthy. Once upon a time, I think we would have called these craft rubber dinghies, but now, of course, they're made of very tough PVC. But on the other hand, look at the manufacturer's recommendations for these craft, and the model I'm thinking of, which we see video and still pictures of all the time. The manufacturers recommend that they should carry no more than 10 people. Well, we've all seen pictures that show 20, 25 people crowded into these tiny craft, and it's no surprise that deaths result.
I want to move over back into American politics, and I'm dumbfounded that the Republican minority leader Kevin McCarthy didn't realize what was going to happen to him. But once again, Marjorie Taylor Greene has laid out a list of demands. Now, this is a list of demands. Quoting her now, we know that Kevin McCarthy has a problem in our conference. He doesn't have the full support to be speaker. This is from someone who can be labeled as definitely. Used to be labeled as an outsider looking in, but now is more and more the voice of the Republican Party.
Sure, and more in Kevin McCarthy's case, a toady for the former president as well, that fellow in Mar-a-Lago, or the former guy, as our current president calls him. But we should recall some other former guys, too. Remember a man called John Boehner?
Yeah.
Republican leader in the House, it's becoming a tradition now that the Republican leader of the House, the leader on the Republican side, I should say, has the most one of the most impossible jobs in the world, wrangling Republican congressmen and women, and the redoubtable Marjorie has made that very clear. But it's nothing new, and the stakes are higher now because, of course, with the midterms looming, it's perfectly possible that we're talking about that position being brought into question, that leadership position being brought into question the way it is, might be leadership of the whole House. It might be the speakership we're talking about eventually, come another November. But we'll see. But yes, the GOP is the Grand Old Party is every bit as riven as the Republicans often accuse the Democrats of being. Riven, divided, chaotic. You can choose your adjective, but trying to lead it is one of those impossible tasks, the kind of poison chalice that no politician would in their right minds, embrace. But on the other hand, if you want power, you often have to put up with an awful lot of difficult times and awkward customers to wrangle if you're going to try and be the wrangler-in-chief.
It's interesting because the way people have been looking at the Democratic Party, even though Joe Biden's three big wishes to get out of Afghanistan, which the eventual leaving Afghanistan was poorly handled, but it is also Build Back Better and the infrastructure. Those are three major points that he's managed to get through, and it's created a lot of angst amongst people. But I'm of the opinion that someone like this Green putting out and laying out demands like this on the Republican Party, it will also become a very big part of the midterm elections overall.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the shape of the debate, if that's what you can really call it, vituperation is the word that occurs to my mind. Over the next 12 months, is going to be. It's laid out very clearly now. We know exactly how this year-long campaign is going to be fought, and whether the American public buys it or whether they don't, and keep the keep both the House and the Senate in a very tight sort of balanced situation that it's in now. I say balanced, meaning in the sense that it's a very tremulous kind of balance, but balanced it is, or whether it tips. Is the question before us, and we can already see the shape of the debate and the stakes will remain high, and I think we're in for the proverbial bumpy ride between now and next November. Meanwhile, of course, COVID continues to be the backdrop. Even though every now and again we seem to think that we've got something like a light at the end of the tunnel, but I think while all those three areas that you mentioned are important, I think the conduct of the COVID pandemic will remain the big question over all our political judgments between now and when we next go to the polls nationwide, and of course, looking at it internationally, we've now got a new variant of the COVID virus spreading in several southern African countries, which is creating great concern. The countries involved are South Africa, Botswana, Namibia, Lesotho, Eswatini, and Zimbabwe. Let's not forget Zimbabwe in this. And there's a great deal of international concern about that. And here in this country, we still have surging numbers, mainly in the Midwest states. But this new variant, I think, is one for all of us to be really, alert to. It's known still only as B1.1. What's the final number? 529 subcategory, and it will get mercifully a single Greek alphabet letter as a name, and that will probably happen today. The World Health Organization is convening a special meeting to consider the new variant. So far, it's occurring only in small numbers, but it's causing great concern. Britain, for instance, has suspended flights from those five countries that I was talking about, the new concern really underlines the broad picture, which is so utterly outraging much of world opinion, that the rich countries are monopolizing the vaccine, hogging it is the word that I keep reading in poor countries' media outlets. Africa's the worst hit, of course, only 6% of the continent's total population being vaccinated. And what a contrast that is with countries in the rich world, where an average of 70% of us are vaccinated. So inevitably, the COVID pandemic is going to stay with us, and the anxieties that it provokes, and in different countries, different ways of handling it, I think are going to be the predominant factor in all political contests that loom before us.
And it's interesting, David, that to look at COVID, and there's so many stories coming out of so many different countries all over the world that differ from one side to another. It's no wonder that the world, the entire world, not only America, is confused and bewildered and befuddled by this.
Yeah, and it's subject to that same, certainly in our country, it's certainly subject to that polarization that we started off talking about today. I mean, everyone, it seems like everyone has to take a position of reaction to things like vaccination, things like restrictions. But you've got a pattern very clear from here with our Midwest problem to Europe with Austria going into lockdown again, and Germany looking as if it's moving that in that direction too. That it is now unquestionably a pandemic of the unvaccinated. I mean, the problem again and again is the fact that there is a large pool of people, no matter how many do get vaccinated, there is still a large pool of people who are not vaccinated, either because, as in this country, they don't want to be, or in an African country, because they can't get access to the vaccine. I mean, it's still, the problem is the low numbers of people being vaccinated, that gap between the vaccinated and the unvaccinated.
Lots of things to talk about every week, David. It's always great to speak to you on the Media Beat. We'll speak to you again next week.
I look forward to that.
David Tarachuk and the Media Beat here on Robinhood Radio. You can find David's website, of course, themediabeat.us, and you can find David on our on-demand page, which is robinhoodradio.com on demand. David Tarachuk, the Media Beat.